Okay, so this morning, we'll talk about massive stars. I always like to still repeat the importance. Why do we do this? Of course, we do it because it's fun, but why do we do this? We have to justify it. So what is the key importance of massive stars? Well, they have three major feedbacks: radiative, kinetic, and chemical feedback. In order to determine this feedback, we're going to calculate evolutionary tracks, then progenitor structures, note that the kinetic feedback from winds is generally as important as supernova, those who are not familiar with this, and then we want to determine, at least I like to determine, the full nucleosynthesis production. And this feedback takes place from Big Bang plus, let's say, 500 million years up to now. So stars matter throughout the evolution of the universe, also why we want to understand the evolution of stars, not just now, but also in the early universe, because we can observe the explosions of massive stars in this time, and also look at the chemical signatures in low mass stars that have a lifetime longer than the universe. This is why we want to have all these different aspects of massive stars, and also we can use nucleosynthesis as a way to constrain the models in addition to the other methods. Okay, so in order to model stars, we need many ingredients. So model ingredients. So we need nuclear reactions. So as people still come in, you see that I've just done a very brief introduction so that nobody misses important results. We've heard a lot about rotation last week. Today I will talk about mass loss and convection. Double underline convection, this is the main topic. I think Stan Owoki will talk about mass loss, but also I'll just list the questions that I think are important concerning mass loss. Then we have magnetic fields, binarity, and then we have the extra things like equation of state, opacity. Okay. So as I said, I'm going to briefly talk about, so now to the plan of the talk, I'll briefly mention mass loss. I'll talk quite a lot about convection. In terms of convection, I'll talk about 3D modeling of convection versus 1D. So it's 3D versus 1D. And then in the end, we want to combine the two, so it's going to be 3D plus 1D modeling. And I don't have time to cover everything about convection, so I'll specialize on what I will call convective boundary mixing.
I'll keep it simple. Mixing of elements or mixing of momentum? Angular.
I'll call it CBM for short, so whenever I say CBM, to the question of angular momentum. For angular momentum, this is not crucial, and because people talked about rotation last week, I won't talk much. And actually, there is two processes for angular momentum that contribute. In this region, there's the dynamical shear and the convective boundary mixing. And that's an interesting, I'll talk about kind of shear induced by convection, and there's also shear due to differential rotation. And the full picture will be considering both. Today, I'll only mostly talk about shear induced by convection, and the main effect is on the structure and extent of convective boundaries. So not so much on angular momentum.
So it's mixing of material.
And entropy. Was there another question?
So this few years ago, it's about nuclear reactions. This few years ago, I think the carbon and oxygen nuclear reaction rates were not known very well. Do you know if they're well improved or whether it changes anything?
Okay, not very well is 30% uncertainty, which is still pretty good compared to general uncertainties in astrophysics. People in nuclear physicists keep working on it. I don't think there's been a drastic reduction in the uncertainty. Maybe it's 20% now. There's been a new rate for carbon 12 alpha gamma, I think. Okay, so now we have a plan. This is my 2D Kippenham diagram, so summary of the evolution of massive stars, and also linking to why do we care about convection, because if we plot the evolution of a star, then we see convection everywhere. So this version, who's not familiar with this? Please raise your hand. Why bother? There's always somebody who is not so familiar.
It's general terms, but not all the way to the bottom.
So here we have the center of the star, the surface up here. So this is in Lagrangian mass coordinates. And we scan through the evolution of the star, following all the burning stages, hydrogen, helium, carbon, neon, oxygen, silicon burning. And you can see the lifetime of a burning stage on the x-axis also. This is the time left until core collapse in a log scale. And we have to use this scale because silicon burning lasts about a day, whereas hydrogen burning is more than a million years. And we can see how, for example, carbon burning evolves from burning in the center into successive shells. The top colored part here is the convective envelope, and we see the effect of mass loss by the solid line at the top, which is the evolution of the total mass. This is a 15th solar mass star, doesn't lose much mass, but nevertheless we'll see that if you had a 60 solar mass star, you would wipe all the convective hydrogen envelope away, and that highlights the importance of mass loss. For those who are interested in colorful diagrams like this, I wrote a script to do a proper one, although this one I spent quite a bit of time. You can see here I added an extra line, which is the location of a radius coordinate. So this is 10 to the 9. So we also see how the contraction of the core as it goes along. So we see, I'm going to talk about carbon burning shells, and you see that the rough scale is 10 to the 9 centimeters.
Color coding.
Color coding. Some people know, so don't tell the answers. What could it be?
Superadiabatic gradient?
No. Is the velocity? The energy
duration.
Somebody said it, Mach number. So, V over sound speed.
Convective over sound speed.
Yes, thank you. Or VRMS. Okay, I'll come back to that point very shortly. So we see convection occurs in most parts of the star. And before I go too much discussing about convection, let's talk about mass loss. So I think it's the key physical ingredient for stars more massive. Let's see, than 30 solar masses. That you definitely lose them more than half of the initial mass. Of course, after that, we can talk about binary interaction in lower mass stars, but even whether the star is single or not, above 30 solar masses, the mass loss is going to do a lot of changes into the structure of the star. Okay, and then I just want to list, two things. And I want to separate stars into hot stars. So that's like O-type, Wolf-Rayet stars, and these are line-driven winds, and we have a theory for it, we have models for it, they correspond to observation within a factor 2 or 3, so I would say it's not perfect, but I put a nice tick.
If you
you put the temperature on that, the atmosphere, what would that be?
Okay, yeah. So 10 TF larger than, let's be rough, 4.
4.5.
Somebody wants 4.5?
We should just make a bit of a difference.
ONB stars. You see, we get into the details. My main point is, so maybe OB stars. My main point is about cool stars. So that's TF, I would say less than 4 point something, let's say 0.5, to be consistent. And here there's no precise theory that I know of, right? We know that pulsation plays a role, and dust plays a role. We have continuum-driven winds for LBVs, but I would say this is in a much worse shape than for hot stars. And fortunately, I don't know if there is a precise plan or strategy to improve the situation. So that impacts what happens to the convective envelope, because we are not exactly sure how much mass this should lose. I think we can. Another point, I was at a conference on supernova 2 weeks ago, and people with supernova observations observed the circumstellar material, and they say the observations are not reproduced by models. And I said mass loss in the red supergiant is a formula that is empirical. We use an average quantity. Therefore, we have a smooth wind in the red supergiant. But I do not even think that any of us would think that this is what happens in stars. And the models are not designed to study phenomena on the time scale of years. They are designed to follow the evolution of the entire star for the entire lifetime. And therefore, we would need maybe one branch of stellar evolution to specialize in calculating models for circumstellar interaction studies, where we follow the mass loss. So we vary mass loss over the time scale of years to compare to observations. So I'm not surprised that supernova observers find differences compared to what we see in the models, but Norbert is thinking hard, so maybe we can discuss this at the end.
To that point, in your log timescale, do you think that that this 10 to the minus 2 part of that diagram is robust?
Yeah, silicon birth is about a day.
Yeah.
So I think what observers see generally for supernova is around here. Right? But, oops. Oh, sorry, we're here 1 year. I've messed up my diagram. So in...
What do you mean the server seeking?
Does anyone think that's robust? That was the question.
Yes, we see that they don't agree with what we use, but what exactly we see.
So observers observe supernovas on a time scale of years. Mm-hmm. And they see mass loss rates or circumstellar material, which is not really reproduced by stellar evolution models.
What do you mean observers see?
I mean, I can believe that you think it's less than that.
What do you mean by that? The observers generally only see them after it exploded, right?
Well, okay, so the... All right, right. So, of course, you observe the supernova when it explodes. Observations have a time scale of a year. So you observe, but then you can go back to the progenitor evolution. Okay, I should have written it like this. The look back time that you can access with supernova observation goes to roughly a year.
Well, you observe a supernova for a year, but you probe the mass loss on a time scale of hundreds to 1,000 years. Because the easy way to think about it is the supernova and shockwave is staying at 10 to 4 kilometers a second. This supernova, the stellar wind, is 10 kilometers a second. The ratio of that number gives you 10 to 3.
Can you distinguish between mass loss that's happened in the last year versus what's happened in the last 1,000 years?
Well, when it happens.
If you see narrow line emission, you have a velocity.
I'm talking about the explosion in terms of looking at the things that you observe.
Yes, when it happens.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a lot of scale.
It doesn't have to go too much.
But can you say, so is it much higher than what we use? Like when you say it's different, can you just...
We see much more details, and it's not constant, and sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's just different.
And it could be a completely new episode of mass loss, quite unrelated to what happened back in Heliobert.
In stellar models, because, yeah.
totally different. Driven by the startup onset of the oxygen. Jim Fuller will explain all of this.
So will Elliot.
Elliot will explain.
Okay, because I want to finish my talk on convection, I'll just read the other questions. Maybe I should skip them. Let me just read them. Mass loss near the Eddington limit.
Yes, the original question was, how much you trust the latest convective burning feature?
I know, I'm only talking about mass loss. My main point here is that...
This is like a white press conference.
We are talking about challenges in massive star evolution. My main point is concerning mass loss. There is no precise theory of mass loss in cool stars. That's my main point. Of course, we are all specialists, so we can always discuss more and more details. But that's my main point. That hot stars, O&B stars, have a mass loss rate that we understand theoretically with some uncertainty. But for cool stars, we don't understand it theoretically. That would be my main point. I'll skip mass loss for the rest.
Okay.
Let's go to convection.
Before we go on, I think one of the things you should say is that even in hot stars, you don't understand LBV mass loss very well.
Yes. Let me add LBV to cool stars.
Oh, but they don't necessarily have to occur in the cool star phase. It'll still be pretty hot. I think they're close.
So Stan, would you say there are three regimes? So like the very hot regime, which is line-driven, which you basically understand. And there's the very cool stars that we don't really understand, but that we think they have very slow outflows. And then there's a regime in between where there somehow is a transition between those two wind regimes.
I think that the steady-state winds that work well for hot stars and even Wolf-Rayet stars, if you don't look carefully, if you don't get too hung up. I think those are pretty well understood, but episodes of mass loss, like during the eruption, they're not hot. And they keep occurring at the time when the star is still quite hot.
Okay, let's switch to convection. I know there's lots of interesting things to discuss about mass loss, so you know already. Okay.
Convection. I mean, this diagram is wonderful, and I guess I just would like to, you know, you could pick apart everything after sort of, you know, the look-back time of 100, for example, and ask, okay, what parts of this actually are solid, and what, you know, there's a big, you have this big convective envelope going all the way in. I mean, so
that's what I'm going to talk about.
The diagram accurately represents what happens in 1D code like this.
And most codes find that. So pretty much all the codes find structures.
Making the next jump to reality is good luck.
Okay.
Let me discuss this question in greater detail. Okay. Convection, like many other physical ingredients, are 3D in nature. Therefore, ideally, we want to simulate them in 3D hydro simulations. In our dreams, we can do that, and then we don't have to worry about all these uncertainties. In reality, what happens is that we have major advantages of 3D hydro simulations. Obviously, we model things in 3D. So 3D processes model explicitly. And in addition, we can simulate advection processes. So we don't have the restriction of 1D, where things have to go in one direction only. You can have flows going in both directions at the same time. Now, what are the realistic limitations? The main realistic limitation is computational cost. If we want to resolve a star with 1,000 grid points in 1D, we want to do it with 1 billion points in 3D. Okay? So that's the major limitation. That's the spatial limitation, right, resolution. And then we have the time scale. Because most 3D hydro simulations are time explicit, where we follow the sound speed. And therefore, we limit it to dynamical time scale. which is much smaller than evolutionary timescale. So dynamical timescale is generally of order of seconds around here to about days in near the surface, and then you have given you the timescale in years for the evolution. So realistically, we can never model the full evolution of stars in 3D. That's a fact for me. Some people are thinking quantum computers will give us this. I'm pessimistic. I'm generally optimistic, but not in that sense. The other major problem, so that's about the time scale, the spatial scales.
Could you split it up? Could you calculate something on the slow time scale until, say, 10 to the 2, and then take that as a starting point for an additional calculation that goes faster? And
I'll show you a simulation that covers this. Okay. About less than the width of the line. And I'll explain the strategy to overcome that problem, as you mentioned. Okay, there's the spatial scale problem. Is microscopic processes occur on very small time scale. And this is addressed by DNS simulations. Whereas the star is, as we know, much larger than us. So these are the field of implicit large eddy simulations, where we resolve the largest scales or the smallest scales. At the current time, we cannot resolve both at the same time. So we have to choose one or the other. They're both complementary. What seems to save us for convection is that larger scales dominate energy transport and time scales, and therefore we think that this is appropriate for convection. Okay, in terms of time, because everything, all the energy in 3D goes from the larger scales down and dissipates to smaller scales. So at whichever small scale it dissipates, it doesn't matter too much if it doesn't affect the large scales. And these are the dominant scales for energy content, the rate of dissipation, and so on.
Just a note that this is true in eye dynamics, but it's potentially not true in magneto eye dynamics.
Okay.
The relative inverse of scales. So.
Yes. Let's start, yeah. Let's briefly talk about a numerical Reynolds number. So this is basically U L over nu, right? And we know that the flow is turbulent if Re fully turbulent if it's larger than 10,000, and starts to be turbulent if you reach 1,000. Now we can show that this is roughly equal to the number of grid points in one dimension to the power of 4/3, which means if we briefly estimate this, we want to have 1,000 grid points across our convective zone if we want to be fully turbulent, and we need roughly 180 grid points if we want to start to be turbulent. Now, you probably all know that turbulence in stars is not 10,000, it's more like 10 to the 15, which is way off our capability. And so let maybe write stars Re. I'm wrong by orders of magnitude here, but you get the picture that it's far out of reach of computers. But let's say we hope to reach something that is fully turbulent at least. That requires 1,000 grid points in the convective zone in one direction. That roughly means that you want to have, if possible, 2,000 cube simulations. It's possibly, like in the simulations for us, we have half of the domain in the convective zone, half in stable radiative zone. Now you can argue again about this number. Unfortunately, it starts to matter exactly what you want to reach because of the computational cost. Okay, that's for 3D. So 3D is nice, One other point I forgot to mention is here is initial conditions. What you get as a result of the 3D hydro simulations, because they have such a short time scale, we have to be very careful with the initial conditions that we put in, because that can influence our results. Okay, 1D models have the reverse problems, right? They have the advantages is computational cost is low. We can simulate the entire evolution. We can use as many grid points as we want. Negative points is we have to approximate the 3D processes with theoretical or numerical prescriptions. So plus slash minus opposites. Okay, so let's look at convection in more details. How do we implement convection in 1D code? And we have different aspects to take care of: energy transport, boundary location, and the convective boundary mixing, which I want to focus on. So let's talk about energy transport. Generally, we use a mixing length theory from Bohm-Vitens 58. And I have great respect for her work. Generally, it works inside the convective zone. Since I'm interested in convective, the boundary, that's where it breaks down. And actually, the MLT does not provide us with the boundary location. I have to say here, we have updates like the full spectrum theory, for example, but they provide similar results. Okay, so for the boundary location, we have to use the Schwarzschild and Olodou criterion. Norbert talked about this. Olodou. Okay, so we would argue that physically the Olodou includes mean molecular weight gradients, therefore it's a more precise one physically. The problem is if you use either of these criterion, you cannot reproduce observations. So what people have done is to consider what I would call CBM. I call it convective boundary mixing, not to link it to a specific physical process, because I think there are several processes. I'm going to talk about them now. But I purposely do not call this overshooting or anything else. I call it CBM. So CBM needed to reproduce observations. And this CBM is also composition dependent and dependent on many other things. So how do we implement CBM in different codes? I won't talk about all the codes. I'll talk about GenEC and MESA mostly. I think it covers generally the basic ones. So CBM prescriptions. So on one side, I have what I'll call penetrative overshoot. So one reference is SUN 91. In this case, we extend the convective region by a certain distance, which is alpha over, that's our mixing overshooting length. We multiply it by the minimum between the pressure scale height and the size of the convective core. Let's do a small drawing here. This is our convective zone. This is our boundary, which can be either determined by Schwarzschild or Ledoux. And then this is our overshooting region, where we basically displace the boundary instantaneously, at least in GenEC, that's what we do. And this zone becomes then fully convective, both from the thermal profile and composition.
Okay. Is R convective the radial coordinate of it? You've drawn it, so I'm guessing that's the top of the convective zone?
Yes, so this is for the convective core.
Yes, thank you.
So it would be... And this is used for the end of the convective burning. Right. Because when R conv becomes tiny, if you try to extend it by alpha over HP, you can have a...
No, of course, because HP blows up. And what about cases where you're not a central core? When it's a convection zone that is...
So in the Geneva code, we only add this...
You don't believe in those other... This doesn't happen.
That's not what I said.
I'll be quiet. Let you answer the question.
Yes. So I think this is an incomplete picture. So I'm describing what is done now.
Okay.
So this criterion is applied here and there, and somewhere else.
Great.
Now we'll discuss further how the other formula used often in MESA and many other codes is the what I call the XD for short. So I'll call this XD. In this talk, it's not a very good name, but that's my short form. It stands for exponentially decaying diffusion coefficient, so it's got lots of D's and it's got an X. Minus 2Z divided by F, I'll call it CBN here, often it's called F0. And one of the first work that motivated this is Freitag et al. 96. So on the board, I'm allowed not to be complete for citations, but I think a few of them is still useful. Okay, so in this case, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is again, convective zone. Now here I want to draw also. So if we have mass or radius, let's use radius for now. If we plot the diffusion coefficient, this is our over HP. Can either have a constant D up to this point or a D that decreases. In Geneva code, we use a constant D. I think that's not the main point here. If we then have the same plot for this formula, then we have a diffusion coefficient that starts to drop before the boundary, and then that's the exponentially decaying function here. You see that you have to fix a D0. Now, one of the weaknesses of mixing length theory is if you take the diffusion coefficient at the boundary, velocity 0, D0, that's why you kind of have to go back a little bit. And generally, this distance by default, or if you don't know anything else, you can use this FHP to go back a little bit in the convective zone.
What's Z in that formula?
Sorry, Z. distance from boundary. So in this diagram, I'll still put R or RZ. This is generally vertical distance in the star.
But you don't want it to go negative. It's negative. Z from where you start to slope down.
Z is this.
So it's somewhat below the boundary.
That depends where you fit your D0, right? If you had a constant D0 up to the boundary, then you would start distance from the boundary. But if you start your D0 here, then you start from this point onwards.
So in this prescription, does it affect only the mixing or energy transport too?
So here we have the convective zone. If I understand correctly, this the convective for the energy transport, this is the convective zone. I think this part is considered radiative. Is this what you think also?
Yes. Okay. So it's only for mixing?
Correct. Yes.
You should have the same thing for the step overshooting.
So you don't have actually more convection in this semester, it's not done that way, and I wouldn't expect it to be, because the actual distance a blob would overshoot is tiny.
No, but if you say it's efficiently mixed and the process is much faster than evolutionary timescale, then you would also transport entropy and flatten the entropy profile.
Yeah, but that's not what happens. So this is increasing this way just to say this is efficiently mixed compared to the timescale of evolution. Doesn't mean that it's dynamical as well.
Why? If a convective overshoot is dynamical, it's going to do it on a dynamical timescale.
Yeah, but it's not dynamical. A blob with a convective velocity will bounce in a tiny fraction of the pressure scale height.
Yeah, we'll come back to more details about this in a while. So we can argue about how accurate or correct these formulas are. So far, I've described them. I think I want to add a third one.
So is that a different stuff between Geneva and...
Yeah, a good point to mention, maybe. So in GenEC, this region has, so you call it Nabla pad, right, for the thermal gradient. And Mesa uses Nabla rod.
The physical motivation for the exponential decay, does that come from that you view this as a wave that's being done into...
That's a very good question. So whether we are not certain yet what it is, okay? That's the short answer. What you'll see in the movies is that there is some Kelvin Helmholtz. Maybe I should just mention the MLT here. The picture is you have a blob of matter that goes up and down.
Sure.
And here V equals zero. Not supposed to talk too much about this because David Arnett will do this job much better than me when he comes.
He's not coming.
Okay.
Go for it.
Thank you. I think he might still come, but we'll see.
That'd be great.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about it. That's the mixing leg picture. Your blob goes up, and it's true that if you have this picture in mind, your blob will not go very far here, right? And that's kind of maybe your argument for saying this region is actually not mixed on a dynamical timescale.
No, that's not really it. So if you take the convective velocity that's significantly deeper from the boundary, and think of that velocity overshooting from the boundary, at least during core hydrogen and helium burning, that distance is extremely tiny. It doesn't match what's used in the...
Possibly because you use the mixing length velocity, which gives you zero here. But in reality, the velocity here is not zero. Acceleration is zero.
Yeah, but I'm saying you don't use the velocity. There, you can use it slightly deeper in what gives.
Yeah, but I'm saying the velocity. You can argue then what to do at the boundary, okay? But the velocity, my main point will be the velocity is far from small. Okay, you've seen the movie. That what happens is not that the blob stops; is the blob is turning around. And here, the horizontal velocity is smaller, but roughly similar magnitude to the RMS velocity.
So it's the vertical component of the velocity that gets small, but not the velocity vector.
Exactly. And the boundary is defined at the point where A is equal to zero. That's MLT. But that's what it's supposed to be, the Schwarzschild criterion. Whereas if you use MLT, you have V equals zero. So that's another difference. I think the major difference is what happens is you don't have a blob going just up and down. It's turning around. And then you have what we'll see shortly. How much time do I have? Can I last? I have lots of questions, right? So I can do until 11?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Until 12.
Eric is going to leave at 12.
Okay. Okay, last one, which I won't talk too much about before showing you the result, is entrainment. I will show you what it means. This entrainment is kind of in between those two and not exactly the same, but the best way to describe it is this is time-dependent penetrative overshoot. So where it's in the advanced phases, because entrainment has a certain rate. In the early stages, the idea is that entrainment is so fast that you can consider it instantaneous, which is why, as like penetrative overshoot, you say it's so fast that you move it straight away. But when you move to the advanced phases, you can't assume it to be instantaneous anymore, and therefore you have to follow. So here you have kind of an M dot entrainment, whether you follow the time evolution of that boundary. Entrainment itself is still kind of a more like a step process, a step function than this smooth XBT. Now, in the simulations, we have a combination of all these things, so it's not so simple. Okay, but these are kind of the these are the basic ones used in stellar evolution codes, right? These two. This is an additional one, and then the reality is more complicated. Okay, let me. Okay, so this the different implementation of CBM, whether you use this, that, nothing, Ledoux, Schwarzschild, leads to many uncertainties. And since time is moving, I'll just list key uncertainties. This first one is post-main sequence. It's like a feedback loop here. HRD tracks. There's a paper by Martins and Palacios in 2013, if you're interested in this diagram.
Sorry, just going back to the CBM. So I'm a little confused by why you mix entrainment with overshooting in this picture. It seems to me that
I didn't mix it too much, right? I said something different.
Yeah, it seems like a
Seems to me like that entrainment is more like a physical concept that you can observe when you run simulation, while overshooting in those two implementations is something you put into code to mimic some. Like second process.
This is in between because the idea is
in between doesn't help me.
Okay, now let me try. So if we are in oxygen burning, instead of having a d over, which is a constant in time, you have a d over function of time, which is m dot times dt.
So you think of it that way instead of thinking that the convection zone changes in size. I mean, obviously, I can keep. You're saying the TOV is going to get bigger, whereas I might have thought that.
It's a cumulative effect, which is time dependent. In the same way that when you include this XD formula, you have a slow but gradual increase in convective zone size.
TOV is the distance you're overshooting, it's not the top of the convective zone.
Okay, so let me. Entrainment rate are usually measured in terms of mass, so here this is not.
By DMDR?
Let's call it VE then. Yeah, then this way we only have radius.
You're saying the top?
I'll show you a plot of entrainment velocities as a function of radius. So
is there something different between entrainment and the growth, the movement of the top of the vector zone?
That's a very good question.
Or is that just what entrainment means? Is the top of the vector zone is moved?
No, I think they're slightly, both occur in the stars. The entrainment is the process by which turbulent flows gradually erode and push the boundary. But in the star, you have changes in structure, nuclear generation rate, which also lead to growth of convective zones. Right, so if you have a startled burning stage, like in 1D code, here we all have the convective zone that grow. And we could see this as entrainment. Part of it is entrainment, but it's not included in the code. What we see here is generally that epsilon energy generation increases with time, and therefore your turbulent velocities go up.
Okay. So you're saying
it's possibly like turbulent velocity is changing. In addition to when you have a fixed turbulent velocity, you expect to have this happening. So maybe let me write. This is not final yet.
No, of course. So but you're basically you're sort of saying that entrainment is another physical process that we're not capturing at all in either of these treatments?
My naive understanding is that this is like a limiting case where the time scale of evolution is much longer.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that might be wrong. I see where you're going. I think that in the context of stellar evolution, I'll make an argument that, for example, I think for Norbert, what you call entrainment becomes overshooting.
Yeah.
And I think that it's true when you start looking at the small black.
That's crazy, by the way.
Professor Wurtz is
about it. So I think that if we talk about one distal evolution, I think that it's maybe confusing talking about entrainment, but then when we start moving to the 3D world, then it makes sense to revise that concept and see how that might connect to the prescription including.
Oh, because
David Company talked about
because here I would argue that we cannot make the assumption of overshoot in the advanced phases because the evolutionary time scale is too short to assume that it's instantaneous.
Sure.
In the same way, when we can say in the early phases, convective mixing is instantaneous, in the advanced phases, we have to make sure we use a diffusion equation to mix in the convective zone. So similarly, at the boundary, we have this distinction.
Sure. Sneakily introducing the fact that we don't know how to do the boundaries.
So basically, in late evolutionary stages, since like the erosion of the boundary and the overall overshooting is determined by rare events and you don't have enough time, basically the overall extension of your boundary should be much smaller than in earlier phases of evolution. That's what I'm trying to say.
The process has a time scale and we cannot ignore that time scale. Okay, so uncertainties, compactness, compactness is the compactness of the protein in the structure and how likely it is to explode. It's more complicated than this since Thomas Young came right here, but let's say it affects compactness. And then what can be even more interesting is when you have shell mergers. So this is where everything becomes that person has left, she abandoned already. You see here, the blue becomes green. Right? I don't know if you've noticed. But this is the part where actually it should occur maybe here. Here there's a dotted line for silicon shell. We don't have too much time to come. But here we have basically the core is collapsing. And because the core is collapsing, the temperature at the bottom of the burning fronts increases. And this zone can try to merge with that zone.
No, it's not radius. It's a bit confusing.
Yeah. You know that. So in mass, it would possibly stay here, but become one convective zone. But that's, and it even goes up here. Okay, good. Thank you. Right, so this is what I mean by shell mergers. And the details of these three things depend on our treatment of convection, in addition to all the other physical ingredients.
So the shell mergers will be just, but it will mainly depend on how you treat the overshooting or whatever you call it, right? Will, I mean, if you will not consider any movement above the boundary, will you have shell mergers?
It happens in 1D models which do not include any extra CBM. So as I explained, it's generally triggered by the collapse and shells becoming more energetic. What I'm thinking is possibly if we have better resolution and understand the boundaries perfectly and the role of entropy gradients and things, we might be able to be more predictive in saying whether they should or not happen.
If the shell body gets stronger, that prevents the from contact, it's feedback.
Yes, so shell mergers impact
contact radius in
most cases. No, but if you have a shell merger here, for example, sometimes even between the silicon up to the carbon shell, you're going to lift up from the base of this convective
zone. My point is the temperature of the value shell determined by balance between nuclear binding and neutrino rods. So not, that doesn't depend on contraction.
But even during the early collapse?
It's not because of collapse, it's because of you're pumping out energy much faster.
Yeah.
So you go radiate, you go convective because you can't carry it all radiated. Maybe. But it's.
But my point is that
they're all
contraction.
They're all, yeah, they're all.
So there's a feedback from nuclear binding to the pressure.
But if you contract.
Just not contraction.
If you contract yes, very fast.
Keeping some balance. It's not for us.
Okay.
As far as it's hydrostatic.
But this is where it stops from being hydrostatic. It becomes hydrodynamic.
When it starts to collapse.
And it's collapsing.
How does the speed of collapse compare to the convective velocity?
Sorry?
How does the speed of collapse compare to the convective velocity?
Well, it starts slowly but then accelerates.
Sorry.
It's slower in general. Okay, so how to improve 1D prescriptions with 3D? So this is 1D with 3D. And this is part of the ERC Shine project. One of the key aspects. So then we go back to our core diagram, and we're like, okay, where do we start? Convection is everywhere. In an ideal world, by the time I retire, we will have done all the burning stages. I'm almost sure of this, almost. That's why I say almost, because we never predict the future. Okay, so let's look at which one is easiest. This is why I have the color in there. Okay, ideally we would start from the start, hydrogen burning and helium burning. The most difficult aspects of these two burning stages, you see color is blue, the water is a bit cold, so Mach number is low, which is less easy, or it takes more computing time to simulate the same number of convective turnover because you have to follow the sound speed. If in ideal hydro simulations, you want to compute several convective turnover, ideally 10 or more. But we are quite happy from 5 onwards, because the computing time we have is limited. But if you have this, and the sound speed is much higher than your flow speed, then it costs you even more to get there. So it's kind of extra difficult. Second extra difficulty is radiative effects are important. We can't ignore them. So as we move towards the advanced phases, life gets easier. You have neutrinos replacing radiation, so you can ignore radiative effects. Thank you. One less thing to do. Then the Mach number goes up, so it costs you less to simulate the same number of convective turnover. So this is why a lot of simulations have started in the advanced phases, especially for massive stars. The problem is if you go to silicon, which will be the fastest and most interesting stage, then your nuclear reaction network becomes very complicated and messy. So then one of the sweet spots is oxygen burning, which has been simulated extensively by Casey Meakin and David Arnett. So we thought, well, where shall we start after? We thought, let's start with carbon burning. We thought the Mach number was higher than it is. So to compensate for that, we boosted the energy production here to transform a blue into a green. Okay, so that's basically what we did. Several reasons to choose carbon had never been studied before. You can compare it to oxygen burning. It's still in the advanced phases, so it's still relatively fast. And generally speaking, the carbon here follows from the helium burning core, which generally is smooth, right? If we compare this to, for example, this shell, the history here is much more complex. Here, generally, you have two small neon burning shells that leaves an imprint on the structure and composition, whereas here, you possibly have very smooth initial conditions. So we thought, well, let's start here. Okay, so we started here in the growth phase. So here, even in 1D models, when you ask me about growth of convective zone, this is a growth phase. So the 1D model knows it's supposed to grow, and it does grow. But the question is, at which rate does it grow compared to the 3D hydro simulation? Now, I erased it. 3D hydro simulations are very expensive, so we have to make some choices. And one of the key choices to make is the following. This is called star in a box. This is box in a star. As you can see, right? So this is star in box. What is the main advantage of this? Well, you have the whole star. So in particular, you can follow, if you have a convective zone here, you can follow all, like the global motion of convection across the convective zone. This is very nice for progenitor structure, because you can then determine the fluctuations due to convective motions for the 3D progenitor structure, like 3D core collapse simulations. However, you see that your local resolution will be much higher if you switch to the box in a star. Okay, because here you're only going to simulate a small part. So let's say your box is 1,000 cube in both cases. This has much higher resolution. So again, like for everything, we want to do both. They are complementary. None of them is perfect. So we decided for this case to do the box in the star, because I'm interested in convective boundaries, and therefore I want the highest resolution possible at the boundary for the lowest cost. And as I've just erased here, we want to have 2,000 cube. That's for this case here. Okay, so we take the carbon shell, half of it is the convective zone, and half below and half on top is stable. I think I've mentioned most of the important things. So since you must be getting tired, so let's show you the movie.
The lights are next to it, sorry.
Thank you. This is the other thing I haven't mentioned is the resolution. We want to check that our results do not depend too much on resolution. So this is a 384 cube resolution. This is the bottom of the convective zone where nuclear burning heats up the material. You could see how you have this nice picture of blobs, hot blobs of matter going up. When they reach the boundary, they don't simply fall. By the way, this is gas velocity, so it's not really following particles. But you can kind of guess in which direction the flow is going, because a high velocity particle generally continues fast here. So let's start again. Material is heated up, bubbles go up, but you can see they don't fall back down, right? What happens, you'll see it better in the high resolution. You see they fill the boundary, and generally they go up and they disturb the boundary. The disturbances of the boundary create waves, both on top and below. You can't see below, but they exist. They are here. If you plot them differently, they are here.
So where here is like a usual boundary?
Okay, so the usual boundary is there. This is a Schwarzschild boundary, by the way. No CBM. Standard Schwarzschild boundary. This is from a Geneva 1D model.
So it doesn't really ever shoot?
Doesn't really.
So there's no really going through the boundary.
Yeah, we'll come back to that.
They also don't really slow down, right? They basically keep their same velocity until they hit the ceiling or the boundary and then dissipate.
Yeah, so let's look at the high resolution.
That's really speed, right?
That's speed. Velocity, yeah?
Speed.
But you're correct, they just stop there. And you're also correct to say that they don't just go very far. They stop pretty close to the top. It's all about time scale.
Velocities. We have no idea what the material is.
We have an idea.
Well, we guess. You're trying to tell us that for the material, we should take velocity.
We had, yes. We have the evolution of the composition, which is kind of an integrated measure, but nevertheless. Now we see higher resolution, same bottom top. Now you can see better here the flows turning around. And if you look at this corner now here, you'll see that there's some Kelvin-Helmholtz shear instability due to that horizontal motion. So
that's also in the middle.
Yeah. And you'll see that you have entrainment both. What I call entrainment is entrainment. So that you can't see it here by eye, but this boundary is moving away from the 1D boundary. I'll draw you a plot, but you have to believe me because I'm drawing on the ball. But it's going out. I have the real plot if you want to see. Okay. So it's not like going crazy very fast, but it's all about question of time scale. These are time scale of 500 seconds in total. So key point is 1D, the boundary is flat. Here the main thing is that the boundary is not flat. Second point is the blob doesn't just go up there, stop, and falls back down. The velocity is roughly, you can see the color scheme, that the horizontal velocities or the velocity at the top boundary are not much smaller than in the middle. That shows that the horizontal velocity is high and comparable to the vertical velocity in the middle. So now you have kind of different things happening at the top boundary. The surface is not straight. So if you want to approximate this in a 1D model, you take average, then you don't get a sharp transition. Furthermore, you have Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities here. And this can mix material both from the stable into the convective zone and vice versa.
Raphael, could you remind us of the scale of the color of the plot?
Let me show you the other movie again.
Sound speed or something? It's
so these have scales.
What's the sound speeds?
Well, that's why I have the color here. This is roughly, this one is roughly 10 to the minus 2, Mach number 10 to the minus 2. So times 100 this, you get roughly the sound speed. Here you have the vertical direction. So I said 10 to the 9 centimeters is roughly the bottom.
And this is very consistent with what Dayton and Casey found for oxygen, which is not.
Yes. That's the next.
This is good, firing that very consistent mission.
Yes. Before I forget, since time is running, it also seems to be consistent with asteroseismic observation. That's the main point Dave wanted me to make. There's a paper by Dave Arnett and Esan Moravec. And there's some kind of consistency where it's going in the same direction between 3D hydro simulation and asteroseismic constraint.
So seismologists cannot measure
not everything.
Carbon burning shells or oxygen burning shells. Right?
Correct. So what is the similarity? Let's go back to the board. Maybe I've exhausted your patience. I don't know. What is the same? So you've seen, I won't redraw the drawing, right? You remember it. So there are two things I have to draw. Entrainment rate, which is this. And the other one is boundary shape. This is the part where it's similar between 3D hydro and astero. This one we expect it to be very different. So now I'm going into the kind of this direction. This is the middle of the convective zone. I cut it out, and we are at the top and bottom. I'm going to show this is x-axis, so vertical direction versus time. I said you can't see it in the movie, but the boundary does this. The top boundary goes up, and the bottom boundary, something else, down. And roughly speaking, this is a convective turnover time.
Rafael?
So one thing I usually hear from all the simulations is, I mean, you have a 1D stellar structure as an input for it, and since you're using an octet bridge, then once you're actually modeling convection, your model will react, will change just because of that. So sort of convection was not properly modeled at the beginning, now you're modeling convection, and that, well, doesn't that by itself change the boundaries?
You have to run for quite a long time to get rid of any of those transient adjustments to the 1D.
If the structure was totally wrong, I would expect things to change much more than what we see, right? As you said, we don't see the boundary moving. And the 1D boundary was placed more or less exactly where you see it in 3D.
So I guess if it's really wrong, then it will change dramatically on the quantum Noether timescale,
yes.
And it does change, seeing but after that, the grows already many true Noether timescales.
Well, this is the quasi...
So this is the initial adjustment from the 1D structure. Yeah.
So this is the initial transient.
This
is the quasi, quasi steady state.
Like more forever?
So yeah, exactly. So now the real question that comes to my mind now is, okay, this convection is Mach number of 10 to minus 2.
Yeah.
On hydrogen and helium for burning, you have 10 to minus 3, so it's not too different. Now if this was true, if this was a quasi-steady state that will last for a revolutionary time, then you would expect all stars to become convected.
Mm-hmm. But.
Let's
start by repeating what you've just discussed. There's a transient phase where things reorganize themselves, and what I believe is a quasi-steady state that represents something that would be happening over a longer timescale. Okay? Then we have entrainment velocity, which is basically the time derivative of the location of the boundary. Now we can use the entrainment law with the following, which is the following formula. So within one hydro simulation, you take a snapshot at one instant of the evolution, and that gets specific conditions. So that's the point you asked, question you asked quite a while ago. Well, can you just do a simulation here, simulation there? Which this is the plan. This is exactly what we want to know, like how this gradient, for example, which does not include everything yet, all the physics we want, corresponds to this. And this is kind of why we use this relation. So for one 3D hydro simulation, we have a fixed value of the bulk Richardson number, which is RIB, which is delta B times L divided VRMS squared. And this is a key quantity, in our opinion, because it represents the ratio of stabilizing potential energy relative to the turbulent kinetic energy. So this is what wants to destroy the boundary, disturb it. This is what stabilizes the, and then the buoyancy jump is linked to the Brunn-Weissweiler frequency. And then you can include all the Ledoux or Schwarzschild version. There's no problem with this.
Sorry, could you explain that some more? The buoyancy jump, what do you mean?
Okay, so I have to do the other drawing. That's to do with the shape of the boundary. So the outside in the radiative zone, the zone is stable. It's stabilized by what you call a buoyancy jump, which is given by the formula there. I think the easiest way is to look at it with entropy. Entropy is never easy, but let's just draw entropy. And in a convective zone, entropy is roughly flat. Outside, it goes up. Inside, it goes down. It shouldn't go below zero. And because the entropy goes up outwards, this is stable. So when you try to go there, then it's generally the buoyancy force that brings you back. It's kind of the same stability reason as why the zone is radiative and not convective. And but we see we have a kind of a jump is kind of looking over a certain distance L, which still has to be defined. How much stabilization potential you have due to the buoyancy force over this distance L. And then what the destabilizing part is the turbulent kinetic energy. So with this framework, theoretical framework, we can then determine A and N for given
potential.
Sorry?
Is it like a potential?
Potential energy it is.
So that has units of energy.
V square is the same unit.
Yeah.
V square. I mean, if you have N square, right, this is per second square times distance, you have the same. So both have units of meter square, second square. So bulk Richardson number is a dimensionless number. Okay, so we already have two, within one simulation, we can look at the top and bottom boundaries, and they have the same turbulent kinetic energy, but they have a different stabilizing potential. So already with one simulation, we have 2 points, so we can determine A and N. Now the values we get for N still to be improved, but they are between 1 and 1/2, which is expected. This is consistent with oxygen burning simulation done by Mikin and Arnett. Now to the shape. Maybe. So, okay.
So do we expect that N to be constant for any burning phase?
Okay, so A and N, we think they might be the same for all burning phase. But what is very different, not just between burning phase, is at any point, at any boundary, RIB is different. And therefore, the argument that this would continue forever is not the case, because as you increase your convective zone, you're going to flatten your entropy here. You see that your restoring force will become stronger and stronger. Also, as your burning phase progresses, the mean molecular weight gradient increases. So this is why, even in 1D codes, you have this kind of shape, right? It doesn't grow forever, it stops. The fact that it stops in 1D is slightly different, but it's kind of also same ideas, is also the fact that the burning energy generation rate changes with time. Okay, so the growth rate is very fast at the start, and then it goes, slows down.
So are you going to be able to also explain as the vegetation retreats?
Yeah, so here... So that's why the entrainment is kind of the d over the integral of ue dt. This d over is relative to the boundary itself. Now the boundary, like the Schwarzschild boundary, is going to recede. And if you add a little bit, it won't matter, it will still recede. So this is on top of the original boundary determined by Schwarzschild. Okay, to the shape, because that's the point from Norbert. If we have composition, so if we take the 1D case in composition, possibly we have, like, to make it simple, a step function like this. And in 3D hydro, you see a smoother shape. Something like this. Okay. And asteroseismology also is better reproduced with models, but instead of using a step function in composition at the edge of the convective core, use a smoother gradient. And this width here is a figure in a paper of Arnett and Moravici. If you normalize it to the so delta R over R is similar between different phases. So between carbon, oxygen, and the models used to produce asteroseismic observation. And this is a major hope that we can do something that works in all phases, because this is similar between astero and hydro. Now, what do we need to put into the models? We have two things happening at least with the entrainment framework. We have this boundary that moves with time, and we also have to take care of the shape. Now, can we do it both at once or not? Is not clear yet. Right? Because entrainment is kind of this instantaneous process where you move the boundary, but the boundary can be still very thin. I just displace it. This is this. And at the same time, you have the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability that makes your boundary softer. So you kind of have a combination of both. Now, I've said this is similar, but this is quite surprising that it's similar between core hydrogen burning and advanced phases, because the thermal effects are very different. The thermal effects are negligible in the advanced phases because neutrino losses dominate, whereas here the thermal effects are quite important. And this is linked to the Peclet number, UL over psi, where this is the thermal diffusivity. Since we're all getting tired, I'll give you this reference. And how we include this will matter, right? I've done some basic tests here. If you basically include, so it's just a basic test. It's not even with the new theory. It's just comparing the penetrative overshoot with XD formula. Very roughly. Okay, the instantaneous penetrative overshoot increases the size of the convective core very early, well, instantaneously, whereas the XD function has a more gradual effect. So at the start, you have a smaller core with the XD formula, but you have a longer main sequence and a larger core later on.
Sorry, can you explain what the X is?
Oh, yes, sorry. Thank you. So this is MR. This is this.
Top of the convection.
This is kind of the hydrogen convective core. This is time.
Okay, sorry, I didn't feel it at the same time diagram.
No, that's a very good question. Okay, this is only for convection. We want to do the same for rotation. So this is done with the SLH code of Fritz-Röpke. Well, we've already started for the dynamical shear, which is the fastest instability. For the secular instabilities for rotation, this is extremely hard. This is even harder than anything else. Okay, conclusions. Stars are interesting, right? We know. There is hope to be able to implement. So to develop a new prescription for CBM, relying on the bulk which has a number to tell us how the conditions vary and impact the CBM across the evolution, right? Because we can't do 3D simulation of the whole evolution. But at the same time, we cannot use the results of this simulation and apply it anywhere else. Right? That's why we need some theory depending on the stiffness of the boundary. Last advertisement. We have in Europe an action called KETEC. KETEC stands for chemical elements as traces of the evolution of the cosmos. This is a cost action. Going to run from April this year for 4 years, and we're going to link nuclear physics theory plus experiment to stellar evolution and supernova simulations to observations and linking it to computer hardware SMEs. Okay, so looks nice. It's much nicer here when the pros do it. And the idea is to create a data. One of the core result or output of this action will be to have a central website where we can link all our results for stellar evolution, but also plan and discuss between these different fields of physics, right? Because we need nuclear physics rates for stellar evolution. We can then predict what the models say compared to observation and feedback back and forth. What else did I want to say? Yeah, I don't have time to talk about computer platform. I think now it's time to move to GPUs. That's all I wanted to say. Okay, thank you for your attention.
I was going to ask a possibly provocative question as a non-expert in this, but your motivation for the various convective boundary mixing was basically without it, you don't want to produce observations. But from the perspective of a non-expert, right, you had several reasonably physically motivated prescriptions that you suggested, but probably they aren't too strongly physically motivated, because if they were, I would imagine that the experts would agree on which one to use, right, and clearly different experts don't quite agree, right? And so, and also since, you haven't said, well, this is clearly the right one, my guess is right now you don't have the observational evidence necessarily to very strongly tell them apart, except perhaps to say that the more parameters you introduce, such as, for example, well, if you allow an extra parameter to sort of, smooth out the boundary and so on, it seems to make observations better, but okay, but that's kind of a phenomenological statement that if you have extra free parameters in your model, typically you can manage a better match the observations. So, obviously, okay, the 3D work that you're describing is going to answer all these questions, but in the meantime, what should I trust from the various 1D results? Probably some things, don't matter too much, and maybe you get, similar results in whichever prescription you use, but are there things specifically I should trust and things I specifically shouldn't trust?
I'm always positive, so I think they're reasonably. I mean, the main sequence is not so complicated, right? So the main sequence, I think, that's. Norbert is pessimistic, so he doesn't even trust them during the main sequence. Even if you say you don't perfectly understand the CBM, the core is going to be a bit bigger, a bit smaller. Composition at the surface might be different, but the star will not move somewhere be so different. The further you go toward the right, I guess the uncertainties add up. So then it's become less and less certain, but I don't know. That's why we started doing more and more code comparison. And if you compare different codes, okay, they use the same assumptions maybe, but they don't give you the details are tiny, quantitative details are different, but overall picture has not changed. And I don't think I don't think this diagram will totally change once we have the perfect formula for CBM.
Yes. It's not just between codes. Is Anne here?
Yes.
Anne and I have shed blood over trying to just get MESA converge during helium core burning. So a lot of this has to do with how the details of how you're changing some of these overshoot parameters, changing the resolution of the code, changing things. And Anne is tougher than I am, I guess. So it's not just between codes, because codes get different results depending on how you set various tolerances and parameters. And I don't think we're even converged at that level. So I think that's part of the problem. It's that some of these different schemes look great until you really try to push them and say, okay, is that going to converge if I keep turning up the resolution on this? And
it's already in helium burning, right? Not in hydrogen.
This is in helium core. Yeah, right. Main sequence, there are probably problems with main sequence, but I just know that you don't have to go beyond helium burning to already get to where it's confusing.
I think there's a hydrogen burning shell here. That is, I didn't draw it, but that's...
I'm sure that's confusing.
but I totally agree with you, so I'll just repeat your comment that if we compare the codes and put the same physics in the codes, then we more or less get very similar answers. So it's not a question of...
Same tolerances.
So they have different plus and minus point, but it's more uncertainty in the physics than if you use one code A or B. Right?
Sure.
So it's more about uncertainty in the physics. I don't think we have a major problem in codes.
Dreamer.
As I said, I'm positive. No bad.
I'm, by the way, very positive in general, but it's very stable on the main sequence and the agreement with Astero seismology. I think Astero seismology is advancing very nicely and there's many good things coming out. But I think if we look at what has happened in the last 10 or 20 years, for the main problem of overshooting, so how much does the convective core actually exceed the Schwarzschild boundary? I think the results have been quite incoherent, I should say. We have no convergent picture from astroseismology in that question. And now you're saying the second order problem, namely what is the shape of that boundary, is answered. I think I know the verb which you're referring to. I think there's still many issues with that.
You mean this? Oh, so which work?
The line above.
Oh, okay, this one.
So,
as it's said,
it's always nice to find something in the literature which agrees with what one predicts. I take it with a grain of salt at this stage.
They go in the same direction. Okay. That the boundaries are not step functions. Jim?
So I have a question about this Richardson criterion. If you actually want to implement that, so you have this L parameter, which is the distance of the or length of the overshoot. How would you determine that? If I want to put this in a 1D code, how do I calculate L? Because that integral n squared dl, that actually basically just integrates into a density difference times gravity. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, actually is roughly independent of L. But the actual L, then, in the Richardson equation, how do you determine that?
I don't know yet.
I'll fetch you.
Of course.
I was wondering whether there is some hope to have, as Dave Arnett is saying, a kind of predictive theory of convection, because, of course, what he is saying is that in MLT you have three parameters, and a large progress would be to free from these three parameters. But I must say I am a little bit pessimistic about that point. And I would say that we need a star to exist to calibrate the models in some way at a given point. I would like to have your feeling about that.
So there's MLT. I mean, in the interior, maybe I'm oversimplifying things, but the key thing I'm interested in is the boundary rather than the energy transport inside the convective zone. Because I don't think that's... I think it's better understood than the boundary itself. And the goal for the boundary is that we can constrain these two parameters from 3D hydro simulations. If we do that, then we are not using observations to calibrate our entrainment rate. We can also use the shape obtained in the 3D hydro simulation to constrain our shape in the 1D code, and then we can run the 1D model and compare to observations.
So how does this compare to 3-2-1D?
It is 3-2-1D.
It is 3-2-1D. Oh, okay, thank you.
Sorry. Well, 3-2-1D includes a lot of things.
Yeah.
So 3-2-1D, the long-term plan is you replace MLT altogether. Sure. You possibly have the runs equations framework. So intermediate version that David Arnett is working on is to have a turbulent kinetic equation on top of the structure equation. That would replace MLT and the transport of energy inside the convective zone. It will also determine, it should also determine the end location. So instead of using Schwarzschild and Ledoux, that should give us equation should tell us where the boundary ends. This is possibly, how does it combine with it? This is possibly simpler, like version zero.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you see this as sort of a step towards full.
Yes, 3 to 1.
And are you working it like this in check?
We're still constraining A and N, and as Jim said, what to take for L, and what is the next step? Okay. Understanding the value of N. But the idea is to, the first step will be to go from something that is either instantaneous, which was down here, D over, or FCBM, which is constant, to something that takes into account the stiffness of the boundary. And I personally will be quite happy with this first step forward. And after that, the models will still be wrong, but we'll have included the stiffness of the boundary.
Thanks so much. This is actually very nice. I want to go back to the stiffness and the Trendon rate that you find into the 3D simulations. And you mentioned earlier that obviously, given to the limited computational resources, we're not close to the hydrodynamic numbers that are proper to stars. We're getting closer than in other regions, but still. So I'm wondering if you look at how this entrainment rate might depend with the resolution of your simulations. Are you sure that that won't change if you, since it seems to depend a lot on this Kelvin-Helmholtz instability at the boundary of the core, which I imagine might be dependent on your resolution.
So I have the colorful multi-resolution diagram. Have a look before I describe it on this one here. Okay, so it's a function we have. The initial study was this situation with a boosting factor 1000 for the energy generation. We can discuss this afterwards. And we did that for at least 4 resolutions. And roughly speaking, you have, it's not exactly the same slope, but it's similar enough so that we think it's not too resolution dependent. At least we've done a resolution study. What is nice to have, why we do a shell rather than a core, is that you have 2 boundaries. So you already have two answer for the price of 1. And just 1 second. We boosted this factor, the energy generation rate by a factor 1000. Now the next study is to change this boosting factor. Changing the boosting factor changes the strength of the turbulence, but does not change the stiffness of the boundary. The stiffness of the boundary is imprinted by the 1D structure. And then we have additional constraint on A and N. We currently have about 10 points now to constrain this formula. At the back.
So you mentioned you have 2 boundaries. My impression was in fully compressible convection, the statistics of the upflows and the downflows are actually quite different in terms of the transport and the size, even the length scales. And so how does that enter into these estimates? Because I might naively expect a top boundary to be different than a bottom boundary.
Yes.
But if I just have VRMS, that's just 1 number for my convection zone. Is that...
Well, the VRMS...
I mean, delta B may be different, but as Jim said, that's, some...
VRMS...
structure statement rather than...
So I think the...
connected statistics statement.
I totally agree with your point. This is something we have not had too much time to look at yet. And we have here the velocity as a function of radius. And there is... It's true that at the bottom we have the nuclear burning... And it will be important to actually understand if there is a strong effect or not. So this is something we have not fully studied yet. The initial result is that it might not. That's a point we will, because now that we have the study for different boosting factors, we can look at top boundaries separately from bottom boundaries having different stiffness.
Right.
So that's a good point.
And one ray of hope for Josiah's question, I think, is that a lot of these convective zones are only like a scale height thick. So they're not super compressible, whereas like the sun's convective zone is many scale heights thick, and you might generate more velocity and isoentropy that way. So maybe, you know, like in your simulation, you didn't have these really fast, cool jets going down and slow warm-up flows like you see in the simulations of the sun. So maybe the upflows and downflows aren't extremely different. But yeah, there probably are cases like the sun where they are, and then you have to be really careful.
Oh, I think, maybe that's the explanation why they're so similar. That's a very interesting point that we still have to look at. What the burning at the bottom does, it makes also the boundary stiffer, much stiffer, because it raises the entropy, right? So my drawing is not accurate here, but entropy gradient is much steeper here than at the top. And this steep entropy increase is due to nuclear burning. So part of the effect of the nuclear burning at the bottom is to make the bottom boundary much stiffer. And we see this, so this is not to scale, not at all to scale. This entrainment at the bottom is much slower than at the top, probably for the reasons, these reasons.
So that must be much more horizontal.
As we use, we do it, when you do things on board, right, this is the scale. Have I complained too many times about Matteo?
So last question, for me is, this would be great, you know, if it was possible to solve this problem with this, zero order, treat you one
version
because,
zero.
You know, that can be put on top of the usual alpha and alpha, and we'll all be happy. Something that makes me wonder is that obviously in this kind of simulation, you don't capture the very long-term evolution and those rare events that cosmically might add up bulk of energy at the boundary. So you might imagine that running the simulation for million of turnover timescales, you might capture the effect of 3, 4, 5 very rare plumes that once in a while erode the boundary much more than the other. And how can we be sure that these are not the important ones that make the most of the job, and we're only capturing, you know, maybe like an unimportant part of the effect, or maybe both contribute? I mean, that would be my worry in this.
Okay, so imagine that we have to remember we boosted the energy generation rate by a factor 1,000. Do you expect this to happen in a 1D code?
Or in
a star? We artificially boosted the energy generation for our 3D simulation by a factor 1,000. And then what we see is still something. Well, it's not like perfectly straight. That's a bit like this. So you can see actually fluctuations over the convective turnover, which we expect. My personal take on that is that this quasi-steady state will continue. What will change is the stiffness of the boundary due to how the structure changes. But that will be included in this term.
But your Richardson number depends on the square of the RMS velocity. So it's very sensitive to the fact that once in a while bloom will be.
There should be some limits to what the velocity that we maximally can have, right?
Well, that's the question. That's only you need to have a full characterization of the velocity.
The VRMS is, if I remember correctly, is cubic root of epsilon. It can't change that much.
But that's RMS. I'm interested in the fluctuations.
Right. So it depends on the spectrum of
correct
velocity.
Which depends again on the way that convection would work.
But if it's Kolmogorov, there's some spectrum, right? So you could probably try to extrapolate.
That's true.
He's almost mixing the whole style already, so.
Yeah, I mean.
We are not, because this depends on that. And if you plug in the numbers, of course we can have my slides back. Okay, so if by boosting epsilon we obtain a value that is too fast, but if you rescale it with the correct Richardson number, you have the delta I is 10 to the 8 centimeters from here till the end. But you have to compare this to what the 1D model does. In this case, the growth rate is quite fast. Okay. I don't know, the top is 6 times 10 to the 8. This is 10 to the 9. It grows a bit, still a bit too much, but it's not orders of magnitude off. And what happens is this rate slows down. This is, we purposely chose a phase where we expect a high rate. Because this is, in the 1D model, the growth rate is high because we're at the start of the burning stage. When you reach that point, the growth rate will be zero.
And how do you get that out of your equation over there?
So Ri,
n goes
which rate, I can't remember. This term will go up for the reason I've mentioned here.
Okay.
As you grow, your gradient becomes steeper and steeper and steeper, and then becomes impenetrable wall, and your entrainment rate just goes to zero. And you can't integrate, and that's the whole point of using this formula, rather than a constant F or constant D, is that you cannot extrapolate, as possibly the argument is about, you can't extrapolate this result over evolutionary timescale. Because RIB changes, which is the whole point of using RIB in this new formula, so that we reproduce that. A very fast UE at the start of the phase, then it dies, and then actually recedes. And we see, so we artificially vary the boosting factor, and we see that the velocity changes drastically according roughly to this formula. So we've already checked.
What keeps it zero as you start to contract convection zone?
Okay, so because this is a time scale, it kind of deforms the how you look at it. But this is quite short, this phase.
Okay.
So at the very end, when you have almost no more fuel, and the epsilon goes down, and also the mu gradient goes up.
And what keeps entrainment from doing anything? I mean, don't I have to keep UE zero during that period?
Remember that the d over is relative to the to where the acceleration is zero. So this is relative to a equals 0 point. So what happens at the end is that the boundary is here, but so it recedes slower than without entrainment.
So there's a okay. So it's that UE stays small. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. Actually, at this point, it kind of possibly increases again because you have no more mean molecular weight gradient, you have no more entropy gradient. But the main thing is you run out of fuel.
Okay.
So at this point, your epsilon goes to zero, and because epsilon enters this, so at the end, this one goes down, this one goes up, this one goes down as well.
So you expect sort of a collapse of the convection zone at the end. So it's going to be a very quick shut off.
Remember, this is still UE, which is extra length, right? So, but it's kind of what you say.
One more?
Yeah.
Okay, last one.
George afterwards.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you go first. No.
In my simple 1D world, whenever I see a convection zone which grows in mass, what I would expect and what our code always shows is that we actually get a semi-convective zone on top of the convection zone because we have the new gradient, so whenever we turn super adiabatic, we cannot immediately be convective, but must first go through the semi-convective stage, which, by the way, would also produce for some software chemical gradients.
Yeah.
So if you don't talk about semi-convection at all, this doesn't occur in your world here, so how can that be?
It's a slower, this is dynamic at time scale.
No, I mean, probably for the best it starts to work.
We won't see it on the time scale of 1 hour, semi-convection.
Maybe we won't see it, but...
Especially these simulations, we ignore thermal effects.
Well, the mixing of the internal convection zones is on a thermal time scale, but as I said in my talk, so it's an overstable
situation. So you actually have a dynamical oscillation in the semiconductor layer, dynamically.
So okay, so
just the growth of the amplitude grows on the time scale. So
possibly what we have to do to actually see this, we started with a Schwarzschild boundary, so we would not see semi convection.
Also, presumably, you don't actually have different diffusivity. I mean, you don't actually have a double diffusive thing in these simulations, right? They're diffusions at the grid scale, and so you don't have a separate compositional and thermal diffusivity. So even if you were going, right, is that correct? I mean, you could. Well, I mean, it's also a matter of the equations you're solving, right? To see those kinds of instabilities, you need composition and heat to have different diffusivities. Otherwise, it's not an instability. So, and presumably, that's not directly true here. Is that right?
Sorry.
You're not solving the equations with an explicit diffusivity, correct? The diffusivity is just the grid scale.
Yes, in general, that's true. There's no. Well, at the grid scale level, everything is mixed, so that's artificial viscosity. Relative effects can be added to the simulations. We didn't because we are in the advanced phases. George Manet had a question.
Well, I would be just to ask whether you have tried to use this kind of prescription on longer time scale, because you can compute R, you have A and N, so you could compute the evolution from the sense of the carbon binding shell.
As we discussed before, the question is what to use for L. So this is a new PhD project, Laura Scott.
So it's
in 3 years' time, hopefully this is done.
This is the piece which is missing now, right? In that prescription, to the way to compute this
yes.
length.
This is where we are at.
Okay.
As I said, we are at this point. We're trying to understand the value of N that we obtain, whether A is constant for all burning phases or not. The other question was whether burning at the bottom has an effect. This is one point I have to remember. Main positive thing is we have a framework to study this and to answer the questions. Same with semi-convection. The way I would answer the semi-convection question is to start with a model where we use LeDoux criterion, and we see what happens to that semi-convective layer. My initial estimate, I like to do predictions, is that very fast this is overturned. So that semi-convection is very fast. That's my personal opinion. It's not tested, but that would be my guess before I do the simulations.
By doing your simulation, you have a 1L in order to find this expression. You have a value of L somewhere from the simulation.
Yes. It's some kind of distance across the boundary. I mean, because So delta B, it's where things change a lot. I think we've used different things. Something like alpha HP somewhere. I must admit I can't remember by heart what we use.
Thanks.
Did you have a last comment?
Well, I just wanted to know who funds this big project which you have
to say. Oh, Caltech cost action. These are cost actions. This is through Horizon 2020, but indirectly the member countries sign up for it.
And so what happens now that you're
out of the... I thought I had avoided the political question. Nothing to that. A lot of other things. That's not good. Any other scientific question?
Raphael's got a Brexit, right?
I've sold my house.
Would it be interesting to hear all of the Brexit discussion, like off the record, outside of the doors?
I think they can chop the end. Thank you for the question.